Good afternoon. Reporting for WFHB, this is Cade Young. You're listening to the WFHB local news for Thursday, April 25th, 2024. Later in the program, WFHB correspondents Kate Chmielewski and Annika Harshbarger will be live in the studio discussing how you can support the station during our spring fund drive. More in the bottom half of our program.
Well, nothing feels as good as solidarity. Nothing feels as good as being with like-minded people who are fighting for a better world.
Also coming up in the next half hour, WFHB correspondent Kay Weinberg reported on a rally this morning at the Indiana University Dunn Meadow. That's coming up next on the WFHB Local News. Up next, WFHB correspondent Kay Weinberg reported on a rally this morning at the Indiana University Dunn Meadow, where demonstrators called out the university's ties to Israel amid its ongoing war with Hamas. We turn now to that coverage on the WFHB Local News.
About 150 people gathered with tents, canopies, and drums at Indiana University's Dunn Meadow this morning, establishing a protest encampment in response to Indiana University's ties to Israel in light of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. We talked to a spokesperson of the encampment about their goals and experiences. We are interrupted initially by IU administrators and IU PD officers who walked through the camp handing out leaflets, alleging the protest was illegal. Although encampment organizers argue that this claim goes against standard IU policy and that the encampment will only begin to violate the rules beginning at 11 p.m. Palestine solidarity organizers at IU have faced continual threats and harassment from the administration, including the suspension of tenured faculty member Abdul Qadir Sino, the faculty advisor for the IU student group Palestine Solidarity Committee. As of reporting, dozens of student activists in the encampment are being threatened with arrest by a mix of IUPD, BPD, and Indiana State Patrol officers. Now we'll hear from a spokesperson of the encampment.
We are at Dunn Meadow at Indiana University. The Indiana University Divestment Coalition, a group of concerned faculty students, they've set up an encampment in Dunn Meadow to protest Indiana University's relationship with Israel, its refusal to adhere to BDS demands, and the continued tenure and the continued administration of Kerry Dougherty, Raul Srivastava, and Pamela Whitten. All three were the targets of a no-confidence vote just 2 weeks ago, and they refused to make any meaningful changes or resign.
And so this isn't the only place that this sort of action is happening right now, right?
No, certainly not. This encampment is up in solidarity with dozens of encampments all around the country, starting with Columbia University, UT Austin, Harvard, all these other schools around the country. Students and faculty are rising up and making their voices heard that they don't want their institutions to be complicit in the ongoing genocide.
And what has been the university's response so far?
Towards our demands, there's been absolutely no response. They haven't been responsive at all. But towards our activism, they've been pretty hostile towards it. I'm sure some of your listeners and some people who've been following this pro-Palestine activism on campus have followed many instances of our speech being suppressed, us receiving threats from the university. Even our faculty advisor was suspended without good cause. And all of this seems to be aimed at suppressing the voices who are opposing this ongoing genocide and opposing the ongoing relationship between our university and this genocide.
And can you say a little more about Israel's relationship with the university?
So Israel's relationship with the university is very extensive. It ranges from study abroad programs, international programs where students will go over there and visit Israel and interact with a lot of official people. There's the partnerships with military industrial complex companies. These companies have a direct role in perpetuating this apartheid over in Israel. Companies such as Crane, for example, which is an explicit target of divestment for us. Crane, they help develop AI technology that helps Israel's targeting software, and they distribute all these contracts to all these other companies that help with Israel and its war-making abilities. So stopping that partnership is essential if we ever want to take control of our university and not be complicit in this genocide.
Can you say a little bit about just like what your experience has been as a member of this?
Well, nothing feels as good as solidarity. Nothing feels as good as being with like-minded people who are fighting for a better world. I always wish that we wouldn't have to come together for these circumstances, that we could come together outside of tragedies. But tragedies bring people together. That's just how human beings work. And it feels good to be able to just to say with some confidence that this community will not stay silent, that these students here, these faculty here, aren't going to be shut down by the university, aren't going to be told off, told to shut down and sit down and shut up. They are going to be using their voice. They want to fight for change, and I think they're going to be successful.
What are the plans for the IU Divestment Coalition in this action moving forward, you know, past this afternoon?
We'll pass this afternoon. We hope to be able to maintain this encampment for as long as possible. There are some students who are optimistic about our ability to withhold any repression, but we'll see. It's up to the university. If they want to use force, deploy a bunch of armed goons, a bunch of college students in a park, well, then that's on them. But they must know that the people won't be deterred.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kate C., and we are live in the studio during WFHB's Spring Fun Drive. And I'm joined here by WFHB correspondent Annika H. So, Annika, how long have you been at a part of WFHB?
So, I've been a part of WFHB for about 8 months now. I started out as an intern, and now I'm a volunteer.
That's awesome. What kind of stories have you worked on at WFHB?
I worked on a ton. So when I was an intern, I was doing a lot of government stories, like local government. So through that, I did like some stories on the jail and what's going on with all that, and then some student loan stories. And then as I've moved into my role as a volunteer, I'm working on more stories that are kind of more relevant to the town, I suppose. I did a photo story about the IMU sit-in protest, and I did a nicotine story, and then right now I'm working on a story about an adult orchestra, and that's learning for the first time and everything, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. And why do you think listeners should support the station during our Spring Fun Drive?
Well, I think just having a station like this is so important to Bloomington. I mean, it's independent, it's nonprofit, everybody's a volunteer, so you know, all the stories they tell are very important to them, and I think it's just really important to have a station like this at times, you know, when there's a lot of unrest in Bloomington, like what's happening at Dunn Meadow and all that.
Yeah, I think the Dunn Meadow that we just covered was a very good example of the importance of local news and all the great work that this station does.
And especially having a station like this that doesn't need to put ads and everything on. Mm-hmm. To stay funded is really important. I mean, if you see like what's going on with the IDS right now and how they're doing blackout on their news and all that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad we could cover that today. And it's ongoing, so we'll see what continues to happen there.
See how the story develops.
So we need your support for the local news on WFHB, and we need to raise $200 during this very program. So please give us a call at 812-323-1200 or visit our website at wfhb.com and click the red donate button. And thank you for your time and thank you for supporting WFHB Community Radio.
This month, Civic Conversations welcomes Professor Charles Jay, a distinguished professor of law at Indiana University's Maurer School of Law. A widely recognized expert on judicial conduct, Professor Jay has served as a witness in a U.S. Senate impeachment trial, leading to dozens of media appearances on the subject. For more, we turn to Civic Conversations on the WFHB Local News.
You're listening to Civic Conversations, a podcast collaboration between the League of Women Voters, Bloomington Monroe County, and this station, WFHB. I'm Jim Allison, your host, and Becky Hill is our producer. We're very pleased to say that you can find Civic Conversations each month on this station, WFHB, at 93.1 and 98.1 FM Bloomington, and 100.7 Nashville, and 2106.3 Ellettsville. You can also find this podcast at the League website, whose address is www.lwv-bmc.org. Today's guest is Charles Jay, a distinguished professor of law at Indiana University's Maurer School of Law in Bloomington. A widely recognized expert on judicial conduct, he has served as a witness in a U.S. Senate impeachment trial, no less, and his expertise has led to dozens and dozens of media appearances on this subject. Welcome, Professor Jay.
My pleasure, Jim.
Let's start off with a question about why is judicial conduct such a hot topic today? And I mean today.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that our institutions are under stress. Media, experts generally, scientists and government. And within the context of the judiciary, I think there's some doubts about its legitimacy, some doubts about whether the judges are truly impartial, whether they have the necessary integrity. And they started digging a little bit into some of the Supreme Court justices and found there's some problems.
Absolutely. Okay, that explains a lot of it. Now, the media seem to focus on the federal judiciary, but what about judicial conduct in the state courts? And for example, has it been much of an issue at all in Indiana courts?
Sure. I think that the focus on the federal courts is understandable. The Supreme Court is really the flagship for the U.S. judiciary. So when they're getting into trouble, everybody sees it. But things proceed kind of quietly about the states. All 50 states have a code of judicial conduct. All 50 states have disciplinary processes. And the same's true in Indiana, where anyone who is confronting a problem with a judge in Indiana can file a complaint, it can get investigated, and it can culminate in discipline. And I think with Indiana, I'm proud to say that relative to a lot of the judiciaries I'm looking at, it's a pretty good one. I mean, they got problems, and because there are judges in the hinterlands that you just never hear about, it's often, flies below the radar. You don't know that it's there. But on the whole, it's a good bunch of judges. They get into trouble. They do get disciplined, sometimes to the point of getting removed. But on the whole, it's a system that's been in place for decades, and it works pretty well.
Okay. Now, you published a book with what I consider a very provocative title, Who is to Judge? And this book raises the question of whether judges should be appointed or elected. Now, what are the pros and cons of that particular issue? And how does Indiana's selection committee come into that picture?
Sure. I think that all of us are familiar with the federal system where judges are appointed rather than elected. And in a lot of states, there are sort of mixed appointive models. One of the benefits of an appointive model is that you've got judges who are independent of the public, that they aren't going to be intimidated by the electorate. The concern, of course, with them is that they're going to go their own way. They're going to disregard the law and impose their own personal views and that they are basically unaccountable. Elective systems deal with that by saying, okay, you're going to stand for election, and if you mess up, we're going to throw you out, throw the bums out like we do with all other elected officials. The problem with that approach is that if you want judges not to do what's popular, but to follow the law, you run the risk of, really having problems with judges who are losing their jobs for doing their job. For example, a lot of judges feel pressure to sentence more harshly in the months leading up to an election. And I think the idea that you would get sentenced to a steeper sentence 2 months before rather than 2 months after the election, that's kind of a problem. And I think that you can also see that when you have elected judges, someone's got to pay for their campaigns, and you have ungodly sums of money being thrown at judicial campaigns, which can result in the perception that judges are for sale. So you've got, on the one hand, more independent federal judges, but maybe they're too independent. And, we're appointed. And then on the other hand, you've got judges who are accountable, but maybe too accountable. And are not able to sort of follow the law for fear of losing their jobs.
And what about Indiana's selection committee?
Sure. Thank you. I'm sorry. I didn't catch that. That in some jurisdictions like Indiana's appellate courts, you have a system in which judges are initially appointed. And they are appointed with the help of a commission that looks at the various applicants who are interested in the job and weeds out the unqualified ones. And they will send to the governor a list of qualified candidates, and the governor appoints one from that list. They then become a judge, and after a period of time, run for what's called a retention election. They don't run against somebody else, but the public gets to look at them and say thumbs up if they're doing a good job, thumbs down if they're not, and if they're not, they lose their job. But that's a so-called merit selection system that's in place in Indiana and about 20 other states, in which it's called merit selection because, theoretically, the commission is looking at the most capable, qualified, meritorious candidates and sending a list to the governor that are limited to that. And it tries to keep more of the partisanship out of the judicial selection process.
I see. Do you think it works well for us then?
It works well for us. And I think one of the things I discovered in my writing is that trying to say there's a one-size-fits-all model for everyone everywhere is a mistake. In some jurisdictions where we don't trust our judiciary at all, we don't like the idea of taking our vote away in a meaningful way. Those states really don't function well with a merit selection system where we delegate the task of selecting judges to a backroom bunch of experts on a commission. But in a state like Indiana, it's worked really, really well. That, yes, we have Republican governors and we have Democratic governors, and they've appointed people who have backgrounds in one party or the other. But they've tended to appoint capable, qualified people on the appellate level. And so we don't see the kind of pressure that we see in other jurisdictions for different kinds of reform, different kinds of selection, where we're going to have bare-knuckled elections in partisan situations. We don't have that here. We have a stable, capable judiciary that I'm really proud of. I mean, I'm out there yelling at judiciaries around the country when they're misbehaving. And Indiana does not keep me very busy on that score. They have done a really good job over the years. I'm not saying perfect, but they've done a really good job.
Well, that's good to know. Let's turn to the Supreme Court of the United States, that is. Now, the United States Supreme Court recently, in fact, back in November, I believe, adopted a code of conduct for its members, and this is a new thing. Now, do you think that code will help regulate judicial ethics much like it does for the lower federal court judiciary?
I think it has that potential, but boy, am I not holding my breath just yet. I mean, I think that in the lower federal courts and in the state of Indiana and elsewhere, you have a bunch of people who willingly adopt a code, they embrace a code, they have annual programs devoted to how the code should be interpreted. They have sources you can go to for guidance on the code. They live, eat, and breathe the code. There's a culture of ethical behavior. On the Supreme Court, they have never had a code. And they didn't adopt it by just sort of welcoming it and saying, this is going to be a great source of ethical guidance for us. What they did was they were dragged kicking and screaming by pressure from Congress, the media, the public. And so they've adopted a code grudgingly. And what they said was, this isn't for our benefit. We're not doing this because it's necessary for us. We're doing it to dispel the misimpression that the public thinks that we're not already as ethical as the day is long. And that sort of creates a sense of these are not people who are embracing this code the way other courts do. And what's more, if you roll up your sleeves and look at the code, there are omissions from the code that seem calculated to say this code is here for us to defend ourselves from criticism. It's not really to help guide us on a good ethical course of conduct. So if things are going to change, it's got to change from within. The court needs to sort of embrace this code and live a life, you know, subject to the code the way other courts do. And if they don't, it's not going to be worth the paper it's printed on. So I'm taking a wait and see approach.
Okay. I am too. Now, our system of judicial review renders the U.S. Supreme Court relatively free of the checks and balances that seem to apply to the other branches, the legislative branch and the executive branch of government. Do we need to correct this imbalance somehow?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Jim. I mean, I think that one of the things that I've written about is over the course of time, at the beginning of the framing of the nation, the Supreme Court and the judiciary generally was very vulnerable. They were vulnerable to, you know, Congress jumping in and disestablishing lower federal courts, threatening the budget, threatening, you know, their livelihood in ways that really were troubling. And so I've written about how over time a custom developed where we respect the judiciary's autonomy. And I'm a big supporter of that. But you reach the point where if the court's legitimacy is in doubt, if people are beginning to worry that it's becoming a too political, too partisan an institution, that it's not really living up to its reputation as the independent, impartial body that we have long thought it to be, then pressure starts mounting for reform. And I am gradually inching my way towards saying maybe it's time for some reform. I mean, one thing that I really hadn't supported for most of my career, but now I'm thinking about is the possibility of term limits for the Supreme Court. The idea that no one anticipated that these guys would be on the court for 30, 40 years, 2-3 years, and they were out for better jobs in the early going. And I think when they're on there for 30, 40 years, they dig in, they acquire this sense of untouchability, this connection from the public that I think is causing some problems, distancing them from the presidents that appointed them. And what you can do with a term limit proposal is you can conceivably do that without a constitutional amendment. In other words, you can appoint these folks for life, but say you only get to stay on the Supreme Court for, let's say, 15 years, and then you transfer out and are a clerk or a judge for as long as you wish in one of the lower courts for the remainder of your career. You know, interestingly, when the Supreme Court was founded, they told the Supreme Court, you're going to sit twice a year, but then you are going to rove about as trial judges twice a year in the hinterlands.
They rode circuit.
Yeah, and ride circuit, exactly. And so the idea, and that was the constitutionality of that was upheld. And so the idea that you would do something like that and say 15 years is a good long time to be on top of the pile. And let's rotate it through. Let's get some fresh blood. We can keep life tenure, just not on the Supreme Court. I think it's something worth considering. And 75% of the public in recent surveys support that kind of thing. And what's interesting, too, is that liberals and conservatives have both suggested this as a possibility. It's not, you know, a one party sort of proposal.
How about enlarging the court? What do you think about that?
Well, you know, it's been tried off and on. The problem with it is right now the Democrats have thought about let's balloon the court to a new size as if they are so short-sighted they can't see beyond the next election cycle when the Republicans, you know, take control of the Senate and they balloon it themselves. Mm-hmm. There is a reason this failed during the Roosevelt administration. He was an enormously popular president, but he was getting some pushback from his Supreme Court, and he decided he wanted to pack the court. And even Roosevelt supporters said, this is not the direction we really want to go. And I understand where there are people frustrated with the Supreme Court, but my message to them is enlarging the court is a temporary fix that could really cause serious trouble down the road, because it could just be each new Congress starts ballooning the court well out of proportion to how many judges you need to actually decide cases.
If I've heard that his attempt wasn't even called for because 2 weeks earlier, Roberts had already shifted.
The switch in time that saves nine is the expression that's applied there. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Well, to our to you. Thanks very much for a very, very impressive and very informative interview you've just given us. And to our listening audience, thank you for listening to us on Civic Conversations. This is Jim Allison of the League of Women Voters, Bloomington, Monroe County. The League is a nonpartisan, grassroots, citizens-led organization that's been fighting since 1920 to improve our government and to engage all citizens in the decisions that impact their lives. Next month, we will be welcoming Professor Marjorie Hershey, Professor Emeritus, Political Science at IU, and she'll be speaking on the impact of disinformation proliferated through election news and how it influences election politics.
We're back in the studio live. I'm Monica H. I'm joined by WFHB correspondent Kate C. Kate, welcome back.
Hey, Annika.
So how long have you been a part of WFHB?
I have started volunteering here since the new year, so a few months. Still learning all the things behind the scenes and having a lot of fun. So
you're working on a story about the jail right now. How's that going?
It's going really well. It's a personal passion project, I guess you could say, and it's been really great to work on it here. I've talked to a lot of people who love this community and have a lot to say, and with that jail, there's always something new going on, and it's also a long, ongoing process. So it's a really complicated story, and I feel really grateful for this community and the people here at WFHB that have been helping me, you know, get my hands all over the story. So it's a very exciting thing to get working on.
What has your experience been like overall at WFHB so far?
Oh, it's been so lovely. The news director is so great. everyone I've worked with has been really kind, and it's just a group of people that really care about this community and want the best for everyone around them, and it's been really great. I've been listening to WFHB my whole life, so shout out to my dad on that. I love the station and everything that they do.
Why should listeners open up their wallets to support WFHB during our spring fund drive?
Well, the programming here really is community focused, so I think that's something that's invaluable and is hard to come by these days. So like the stories that we've covered today, when you have people in the community covering events that are happening in the community, you get a really passionate understanding of what's happening, and it's so important. I love it, and I think it's really important to support local.
It's journalism at its finest.
Mm-hmm.
We need your help to reach our goal today of $200 during this program. If you support local volunteer power journalism, call us at 812-323-1200. Again, that's 812-323-1200. You can also visit our website at wfhb.org. Click the red donate button and select how much you would like to donate. Thank you for your time, and thank you for supporting your community radio station, WFHB.
Support for the WFHB local news is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. More information online at mpisolarenergy.com.